Qumran. And stress, especially with the great Isaiah scroll, how remarkably similar many of them were to the next oldest copies that we previously had, which date to about 900 AD, so more than 1,000 years later, a testimony to the great care with which the Hebrew scribes copied these sacred scriptures. But he's not here, so that's all the summary he gets. I don't have half the wonderful photos that Dr. Skinner has. I have been to Qumran a couple of times, and so I recognize most of the places. I've been to the Shrine of the Book in Jerusalem as well. But I thought what might be interesting after this wonderful, thorough overview would be to talk about the non-biblical texts, the texts that were the product of the community at Qumran. And it's one thing to talk about what a community believes. That's important when you're trying to summarize huge amounts of texts. But I think it's also fun to at least dip into some of those texts. Most of you will be happy that these are in English translation. I don't have the original Hebrew on the PowerPoint. But I'll follow Andy's lead and say next, please. And here is what has already been referred to. One of the first observations from some of the very earliest translated scrolls were the similarities, even more so than between Jesus and some of the people at Qumran, with John the Baptist. And so I'm not sure which is easier for me to read with my nearsightedness. I might try the same thing in front of me here. You can look at the screen. When these people have been established in the foundation of the community for two full years, talking about initiates to the community, in perfect behavior, they will be segregated like holy ones in the midst of the council of the men of the community. They are to be segregated from within the dwelling of the men of sin to walk in the desert in order to open there his path, as it is written. This should sound familiar. In the desert, prepare the way of the Lord. The tetragrammaton, the four Hebrew letters that sometimes get pronounced Yahweh. Straighten in the steppe, the plateau, a flat place, a roadway for our God. And we shouldn't be surprised that the Dead Sea Scrolls quote Isaiah. We've already heard that was one of the three books they treasured the most out of the Hebrew Bible. But it's also what Matthew, Mark, and Luke all say was sort of the headline over John the Baptist's ministry. He saw himself as, in some way, contributing to the fulfillment of this text, just like the Qumran community did as well, only there, as we've already heard, it was the entire community that was the fulfillment of this, not just one lone figure. And so over time, the conviction came that John probably was not a member of Qumran, but being out in the Judean wilderness as much as he was, he might have intersected with some of their members at some point. There was also an Essene quarter right within Jerusalem where many of Jesus' first followers or Jesus himself could have encountered Essenes who might not have been entirely identical to the Qumran group but would have shared some beliefs. Next slide, please. Another very early surprising revelation from some of the first translated of the sectarian literature was the concept, at least it seemed, there were texts that muddied the waters some, but at least from some of the main early texts, it seemed that the Qumran covenanters believed in two messiahs, not one. The men of the community shall not depart from any counsel of the law in order to walk in complete stubbornness of their heart, but instead shall be ruled by the first directives which the men of the community began to be taught until the prophet comes and the Messiahs of Aaron and Israel. Why two Messiahs? The same reason that led the author of the New Testament book of the Epistle to the Hebrews to wrestle with Jesus is the descendant of the tribe of Judah. It was through Judah that David, the king in Israel, came. Jesus has the credentials to be a royal Messiah, but what about a priestly leader or ruler? They had to come from the tribe of Levi. Except for tribes and individuals intermarrying, which was generally discouraged, you wouldn't find somebody who had the credentials from both. So Hebrews, very creatively, reflects back on an obscure character in Genesis 14 by the name of Melchizedek, who was called both priest and king in a city of Salem. No, not Oregon, not even Massachusetts. Salem before it became Jerusalem. And so, spiritually speaking, Melchizedek could be a type, a kind of model of how somebody who might not have the literal lineage of both tribes could be seen to be both a priest and king. That's the way the first Christians solved the problem. Here's a group of Jews solving the problem by saying, we're going to have two literal messiahs. Next. And the royal messiah, and this certainly is in common with the vast majority of Judaism of the time, was very much to be a military figure, to be a kingly, regal, earthly, political deliverer. We read the Messiah of Aaron will be called Son of God. They will call him Son of the Most High. Like the sparks that you saw, so will their kingdom be. They will rule several years over the earth and crush everything. A people will crush another people and a province another province until the people of God arises and makes everyone rest from the sword. His kingdom will be an eternal kingdom and all his paths in truth. He will judge the earth in truth and all will make peace. The sword will cease from the earth. We're still hoping for that. And all the provinces will pay him homage. The great God is his strength. He will wage war for him. He will place the peoples in his hand and cast them all away before him, his rule being eternal rule. Why did so many in first century Israel, after initial euphoria in following Jesus of Nazareth, start to turn away from him? Why, at the last minute, did huge numbers of people turn away from him? Because it became increasingly clear that he did not see his immediate mission as being the political and military deliverer of Israel, leading the troops against the Roman overlords. He came to be Isaiah's suffering servant. But that was not the primary thing that Jews, and certainly not what the Essenes, were looking for. It's also interesting in a text like this to see the language of Son of God and Son of the Most High used. There are places in the book of John, Gospel of John, where Son of God refers to Jesus in his closest possible relationship to God the Father. But there are other places where Roman soldiers acknowledge him as a son of God, or disciples early in the ministry who later will struggle understanding who exactly Jesus is use this language of Son of God And in those contexts, it may be much more like what we see here. An important and exalted Messiah figure of some kind, but not yet the language or the theology of the Gospel of John. Next. So, who is Melchizedek for the Qumranians? Well, there's an entire scroll that is now called 11Q Melchizedek. And here's a little snippet that says, the Jubilee refers to the captives whose teachers have been hidden and kept secret, and they are the inheritance of Melchizedek, who will make them return, and liberty will be proclaimed for them to free them from the debt of all their iniquities. But Melchizedek will carry out the vengeance of God's judgments, and on that day he will free God's people from the hand of Belial, a name for the devil that we find in 2 Corinthians, and from the hand of all the spirits of his lot. So Melchizedek is a very exalted figure in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but he's probably helping out the Messiah of Aaron, the one who's going to vanquish Israel's enemies, which by the first century are Rome. Here the parallelism with the book of Hebrews stops, and the Dead Sea Scrolls goes in a different direction. Next slide. What about all of Jesus' miracles? Isaiah 35, Isaiah 61 had prophesied some of these. So again, we shouldn't be surprised that two Jewish movements, early Christianity and the Dead Sea Scrolls community, would at times draw on the same texts. But this should sound in some places quite strikingly familiar. For the Lord will consider the pious and call the righteous by name, and his spirit will hover upon the poor. And he will renew the faithful with his strength, for he will honor the pious upon the throne of an eternal kingdom, freeing prisoners, giving sight to the blind, straightening out the twisted, and forever shall I cling to those who hope, and in his mercy, text is mutilated here, hence all the ellipses, and the fruit, something will not be delayed, and the Lord will perform marvelous acts such as have not existed, such as he said, for he will heal the badly wounded and will make the dead live. Resurrection. He will proclaim good news to the poor, and he will lead the something, and he will enrich the hungry. The very text that Jesus himself refers to, preaching in the Nazareth synagogue in Luke 4, and then later in his itinerant ministry in Luke 7 and in Matthew 11, when followers of John the Baptist, now imprisoned, come and say, John wants to know, are you the one? And in good rabbinic fashion, Jesus doesn't answer directly. And he says, go back and tell John what you see and hear. And he refers to these kinds of miracles and ministry. Next. One of the smaller fragments that was among the last very mutilated fragments to be translated, finally published in the 1990s, at first led some scholars to wonder if here was testimony to a slain Messiah. A shoot will emerge from the stump of Jesse, the bud of David, and they will go into battle with And the prince of the congregation will kill him, the bud of David, and with wounds. And the high priest will command, the slain of the Kittim. Can we have a complete sentence, please? Originally they had him. Lost and gone forever. But the fact that the one phrase that can clearly be translated refers to the slain of the Kittim, which seems to be a kind of a code word for the Romans in many of the Dead Sea Scrolls, suggests that no, this isn't a slain Messiah. This is a slaying Messiah, fitting in with the picture that we've seen already, helping God's people Israel vanquish her enemies. But then there are more uplifting pictures. Next slide. Blessed are those who adhere to her laws, Israel's, and do not adhere to perverted paths. Blessed are those who rejoice in her and do not burst out in paths of folly. Blessed are those who search for her, wisdom personified as a woman, with pure hands, and do not pursue her with a treacherous heart. Blessed is the man who attains wisdom and walks in the law of the Most High and directs his heart to her ways and is constrained by her discipline and always takes pleasure in her punishments and does not forsake her in the hardship of his wrongs and in the time of anguish does not abandon her and does not forget her in the days of terror and the distress of his soul does not loathe her. How many times does the word blessed appear? And that's all that a beatitude is a short proverbial saying beginning with the term blessed from the Latin for a blessing comes the word beatitude. There are beatitudes in the Old Testament. We shouldn't be surprised that the Qumran covenanters would compose some. What's fascinating is how many you get in a row, which you don't find in the Old Testament. And you get a whole bunch of them in Matthew chapter 5 in the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus does not emerge in a vacuum. He emerges as a Jew. He has similarities to every one of the Jewish sects and differences from every one of them, but very much is God's revelation to a particular people and time and place in a way that they can understand. Next, please. Were the first Christians communists? Small c. Were they communalists? Well, yes and no. Acts 2 and 4 does describe a common treasury that people contributed to, but completely voluntarily. And not trying to take God out of the picture like Marx did with his Communist Manifesto. But a case can be made, some dispute it, that the Qumran people were even more communalist. When an initiate is included in the community council, he must not touch the pure food of the many, those who are already full members, until they test him about his spirit and about his deeds, and until he has completed a full year. Neither should he share in the possession of the many. When he has completed a year within the community, the many will be questioned about his affairs concerning his insight and his deeds in connection with the law. And if the lot results in him entering the inner council of the community, now he's a full-fledged member, according to the priests and the majority of the men of their covenant, his possessions and his earnings will also be joined at the hand of the inspector to the earnings of the many. Doesn't sound like it's quite so voluntary. Dr. Skinner talked about baptism. He could easily have talked about the Lord's Supper. Both emerge right out of Jewish backgrounds. The Lord's Supper, of course, coming out of, some of you would say, the sacrament service, coming straight out of Passover. But interesting take at Qumran. That was good. Now I know how to say next slide, please. Do it in sign language. After the Messiah of Israel shall enter, and before him shall sit the heads of the thousands of Israel, each one according to his dignity, according to his position in their camps, and according to their marches. A lot of hierarchy. And all of the heads of the clans of the congregations with the wives shall sit before them, each according to his dignity. And when they gather at the table of the community or to drink the new wine, and the table of the community is prepared and the new wine is mixed for drinking, no one should stretch out his hand to the first fruit of the bread before them. Afterwards, the Messiah of Israel shall stretch out his hand toward the bread. He gets to bless it. He gets to take it first. Afterwards, they shall bless all the congregation of the community, each one according to his dignity. And in accordance with this precept, one shall act at each meal when at least 10 men are gathered. 10, interestingly, was the number of a quorum for a Jewish synagogue. So every meal, to some degree, is sacred. Let me try it again. 2 for 2. And I've only got one slide left, so we'll make up a little bit for lost time. Don't go over to the dark side. This is for Star Wars fans. That's not Qumran language. That's my title to the slide. Here's the quotation. After the Messiah of Israel shall enter, and before him shall sit the heads of the thousands of Israel, each one according to his dignity, according to his position in their camps. Have we just heard that somewhere? And according to their marches. And all the heads of the clans of the congregation with the wise shall sit before them, each according to his dignity. And when they gather at the... I just read all that. Okay. What happened to... Okay, I wrote the wrong thing down twice on my notes. You can read it up there. That's what I'm supposed to be reading. Good. And if I could see it, I would read it. We already heard about sons of darkness, sons of light, a very dualistic mindset. There was a time, not even 100 years ago, when scholars said, John's gospel can't be Jewish. Jews didn't have dualistic thinking. That's a very Greek concept, dividing everybody into just two categories, right and wrong. Then they discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls. Some Jews do have a dualist mindset, and they did have a dualist mindset. But maybe one of the most fascinating little, not scrolls, pieces, fragments of text among that last translated group came from something that came to be known as 4QMMT, the Miksei Masot HaTorah, some of the commandments of the law. And now I think our texts match. Because of violence and fornication, many places have been ruined. And also it is written in the book of Moses, you shall not bring an abomination into your house, may also mean the temple, for abomination is an odious thing, and you know that we have segregated ourselves from the multitude of the people. The literal standing temple was too corrupt in their mind. And from mingling in these affairs, you must understand the books of Moses, the book of Moses, and the books of the prophets and David. Interesting reference to the three parts of the Hebrew canon. And also, we have written to you some of the works of the law, the Torah. The identical phrase that Paul uses more than once in his epistles, when he is talking about those who have perverted the Jewish religion, which was originally understood that God saved Israel first. The Exodus came first. Then he gave them the law as a way to live out a life of gratitude to God for his rescue that they could never have done on their own. And throughout all the Old Testament, that's the theology that God promulgates. When Jews are rebuked for getting it wrong, it's because they think they can outperform their neighbor, and God will be pleased with them on that basis, without stopping to think how God's infinite, holy, perfection means the best of humans will never even come remotely close to his standards. Paul had to face that as well. And so when he talks about salvation by faith rather than works, he's not saying we don't do good. For heaven's sakes, he's the one who immediately after Ephesians 2, 8, and 9 about being saved by grace through faith said in verse 10, for we are Christ Jesus' workmanship, created to do good works. But our works flow from God's prior salvation in Christ, which we have received, and they flow out of gratitude, not because we could ever earn salvation. A lot of scholars prior to the Dead Sea Scrolls said, that's just Martin Luther. That's just the Protestant Reformation. That's not first century Judaism. It's first century Judaism. What the Qumranians were saying is the rest of Israel is not performing, is not obeying the law well enough. We're going to do it. Christians have fallen victim to that. I grew up in Western Illinois on the banks of the Mississippi, about 3 hours north of Nauvoo. And if you go about an hour and a half southeast of what's called the Quad Cities, Rock Island, Moline, Illinois, Davenport, Bettendorf, Iowa, you can come to a little village called Bishop Hill, settled in the mid-19th century by a group of Swedish Lutherans who left all the rest of good Lutheranism to start a utopian community. If they just got all the rules right, if they just got rid of all the people who aren't as good as we are and started over, they could be the model for the rest of the world. It barely lasted a decade. It fell apart because the people weren't perfect. Nobody is. The haunting thing that not even the genealogy and all of its amazing abilities in Salt Lake City has been able to help me answer is there is a picture. Oh, by the way, they had 12 leaders. Wonder where they got that from. All of them, old men with huge beards, in the paintings that adorn the little chapel that's still there for tourists to visit. And the one looking fiercest and with the largest beard of all has the last name of Blomberg. My father was Swedish. I don't think we're related. It still haunts me. Qumran is a reminder that connections among religious groups are more complicated and more interconnected than we usually imagine. It's also a reminder of what happens when a group becomes so extreme that they separate themselves off from all of their own people. They didn't fight in the Jewish War in leading up to AD 70. Like those who did, they were largely destroyed. They were waiting for God's apocalyptic intervention in the war between the sons of light and the sons of darkness, and it never came. Out of that destruction of Israel came two groups, Rabbinic Judaism and Christian Judaism, which then eventually came to be Christianity as it was much more populated by Gentiles and by Jews. But it's a fascinating story. I thank you all for coming out. I will leave it up to Craig. We're supposed to be over soon, but I'm happy to stay as long as anybody else is and help answer questions. So come and do whatever you want to do.
I don't know how anybody could hope to follow that that group. Let's give our good friends Craig and Andrew another round of applause for their kind introductions. Nicely done. And you both know the work. Given the lateness of the hour, we've got time for a couple of questions. You can stand in your place, because I know it's sometimes tough to get out of the middle of a pew. Pews being somewhat common in a lot of different faith groups, in my experience. Or we've got a mic up here, if you care to come right up to the mic. Going once, going twice. Here we go. We've got two. Go right ahead.
Use this now.
I don't know of many scholars who would say he was actually an Essene. Did he come in contact with them? Quite possibly. One of the things, I've only been to Israel three times, but each time I learn it in a different way. Tour guides like to